afternoon. My name is Bonnie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Reasonable Defense conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the conference over to Mr. Charles Knight, Co-Director of the Project on Defense Alternatives. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you for participating in today's call. Today we are releasing. Better address the challenge of preserving national strength in the context of a world economy that is rapidly competitive and distinctly unstable. Today's call has two parts. First, we'll have brief remarks from our two presenters, Congressman Barney Frank and the report's author, Carl Canetta. I plan to reserve plenty of time for questions and answers immediately following the presentations. Our conferencing operator, Bonnie, will manage the Q&A. Before I introduce our first presenter, I want to give you a very brief overview of the context for this study. We believe that our national strategy needs to have a longer view, set clearer priorities, seek new efficiencies, and attend more closely to the ratio of costs, risks, and benefits as we allocate a limited national treasury. Many of the strategic challenges we face as a nation fall outside the realm of military security. An adjustment of investment priorities for the national interest is long overdue. America's current security policy, as it has evolved over the past 15 years, overinvests in near-term military power and also misapplies that power by pushing the armed forces into missions that they are not well suited for. Consequently, current policy underinvests in non-military security instruments while also failing to attend to and leverage opportunities for broad multilateral cooperation, which would reduce the security burden for the United States. The United States must carefully balance its diffuse global security commitments with the now urgent need to invest in the preservation of national strength. We recognize that enemies with powerful militaries may emerge in the future, and we believe that the wisest hedge against this eventuality is to husband the fundamentals of national strength. Maintain a strong foundation for force reconstitution if needed, and continue support for basic research and development and the prototyping of new military technologies. Although one could derive a Pentagon cuts list from Reasonable Defense, this report is fundamentally a proposal for strategic reform and adjustment, which then seeks to detail the changes to force posture, missions, and the expected employment of our armed forces. Much of the current interest in the Pentagon's budget relates to the impending sequester of funds and revolves around the question of how much will ultimately be appropriated and spent in fiscal year 2013. Therefore, I'll end my introductory remarks with a quick review of the consequences of the Reasonable Defense Plan for this year's Pentagon base budget. It would reduce spending from the 2013 plan submitted by the White House by $12 billion. This additional reduction from current planning, which would take effect while the economy remains weak, is minimal, about 2%. This compares to the 10% cut that sequester entails. In 5 years, the difference from the 2013 plan rises to about $60 billion in 2012 dollars. This is about a 12% difference. You can find these numbers in the budget tables section of the report. Our first presenter today is Congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts. He has been a consistent leader in efforts to bring Pentagon spending under control and to rebalance our national investment and spending priorities. In just one example of his effectiveness as a legislator, earlier this year he sponsored an amendment in the House that effectively froze Pentagon spending at last year's level. This effort gained bipartisan support, with 89 Republicans joining 158 Democrats in a winning vote of 247-167. The amendment sent a strong message that Congress would not support increases in Pentagon spending. Congressman Frank, I'm very pleased that you could join us today.
Thank you, and I'm grateful for the first-class job that the people who put this report out did intellectually and in terms of analysis of the strategy. Let me just add one point that I had a significant co-sponsor of that amendment. It was a 50-50 deal, and it underlines the point about, I think, the readiness of the country to make some changes here. The man whose name actually was on the amendment, because he was the Republican, is Mick Mulvaney, a Tea Party member from South Carolina. There was a broad agreement, I think, in the country that we are overcommitted, and that's the central point I would make. The group has done some very useful analysis of ways in which we can save money by better and more efficiently and more intelligently going forward with weapons in the current strategic framework. What I am particularly happy with is this latest report, which makes the case very persuasively that we will save even more and with less stress in some ways if we rethink our strategic posture and essentially scale back what has been a multi-decade overreach. Well, let me take it back. It's been a multi-decade assertion that America needs to be everywhere. And this says, you know, the Cold War is over and things have gotten a little better, a lot better in the terms of not having a major enemy. And what it says is, let's revise our strategic objectives to a realistic point, and then we can save a great deal of money. Much of that, by the way, to meet those who argue that, oh, well, this will have a bad effect for the economy, which is extraordinary, because what we have are some of the most conservative members of Congress who tell us that domestic spending by the federal government does no good for the economy, that if we try to keep teachers on and firefighters on the payroll or build roads or build housing for the elderly, somehow because there was government funding, it doesn't help the economy. But when it comes to military spending, they become the most enthusiastic Keynesians. In fact, what we should be doing is withdrawing to a great extent much of what we are doing overseas, this reduction in the permanent stationing of troops, for example, based on a recognition of the new realities. And I really want to quote the opposition argument here. There was an article on the Wednesday, November 7th, Wall Street Journal op-ed page by Jack David and Michael Dunn. Mr. David was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration. Mr. Dunn is a former president of the Air Force Association. And here's what they say. They're worried about the Air Force not being big enough because we're not expanding it. And in fact, we're going to be reducing it. Now, they say, paradoxically, it's because the Air Force has been so successful. Now, let me just read a couple of points here, and then I will relinquish. This is them. No U.S. soldier has been killed by enemy air power since 1953. For six decades, the Air Force has been able to deny operational airspace to adversaries, so U.S. ground forces have operated with little fear of enemy aircraft attacking their positions. But the U.S. relies on the Air Force to do much more than that, including to hold at risk any actual or potential enemy target anywhere in the world, to protect the ground forces of friends and allies, or the freedom fighters in Libya, to protect the U.S. from nuclear attack, to gather intelligence remotely from far-flung areas, to airlift humanitarian aid anywhere in the world. That's what this report is an antidote to. The notion that America's got to be prepared militarily and for humanitarian purposes with the military to do anything anywhere in the world. That's a substantial overreach. This is a very well-argued case for making America still the strongest nation in the world, still far easily able to defend are legitimate interests in those of allies who need it. But scaling back what is a great overreach, given the nature of the danger in today's world, so that we can make the substantial savings that we should get to help reduce the deficit without having to savage social programs.
Thank you very much, Congressman Frank. Next, I have the pleasure of introducing Carl Canetta, who is the author of Reasonable Defense, also a principal author and editor of the Sustainable Defense Task Force report published in 2010, and author of Undisciplined Defense, the 2009 detailed analysis of the preceding 10 years of rapidly growing Pentagon spending. Carl.
My pleasure to be here. I want to highlight a few points, the major facets of the reasonable defense model, and then get into how it is we came to these conclusions. To start with the overarching points, reasonable defense prescribes a reduction in the size of our military from about 1.4 million active component personnel to about 1.15. So that's a significant reduction. It's about 19% all told, and that is the principal way that this model achieves savings when compared to a current policy. And in that way, it differs from all of the suggestions for defense savings, including those that the Project on Defense Alternatives participated in. Up to this point, the approach has been to take a look at the defense budget to find principally systems that people felt were unneeded or that didn't work well, and to say here is an opportunity for savings, or simply to try to find efficiencies by combining functions that are being done by more than one service. What we did was take a more bottom-up approach. And we asked ourselves, what is it that the military is doing in the world today? What works? What is most important to our security? Let's focus on those things that work, those things that are most important to our security, and what type of force do we need to address those concerns? We also took a look at the many commitments we have around the world, the alliances that we're involved in, and we asked ourselves, are these reciprocal alliances? Can our allies, who are also our economic competitors, can they do more? How much, in fact, do they need us? And that is the overarching question behind the entire study. How much is enough for security? And in this sense, we're implementing President Eisenhower's dictum, which is that we shouldn't spend more on defense than we absolutely have to. We should spend all we need to, but we shouldn't go beyond. When President Eisenhower said that, he wasn't speaking from the point of view of someone who disliked the military. He was understanding that our military security needs are just one part of the equation, one part of the strategic equation, and that the real leadership finds a way to balance the various components, the various imperatives that face us. Today, the principal challenge we face in the world is an economic challenge, and there are others as well. We have challenges in the realm of climate change. We have challenges in the realm of fuel efficiency. We are trying to adjust to the fact that the demographics of our country are changing. These are all important issues that will affect substantially the American prospect over the next 20 or 30 years. So you need to find some sort of balance. And the first step is you make sure in each area of strategic concern, including defense, that you are doing your job as efficiently as possible and that you're actually choosing the right tool to get the job done cost effectively. And that was the approach we brought to this question. One of the things we looked at right away was the level of presence that we maintain in the world. This, under current policy, may settle out to around 180,000. That's not operations, as in Afghanistan or Iraq. It's our permanent peacetime presence. And the question we raised is this as necessary today as it used to be? We concluded that the answer was no, that where our forces are mostly concentrated, we have allies who are strong, we have allies that could actually do more, and that we have a tremendous capacity to project power rapidly. So one of the things that our model does is it reduces our presence in the world by about 40%. One might go further, but I wouldn't right away. That is, I think, a significant reduction, and it cascades throughout the entire military, because when we think about 180,000 people permanently stationed overseas, there are actually 500,000 of our soldiers in a pipeline, a rotation pipeline. If we didn't maintain that level of routine presence, we could have fewer soldiers or higher readiness for emergency operations. And one thing that the reasonable defense model does is it shifts emphasis from as much presence, permanent routine presence that we have today, shifts emphasis towards a surge approach. As I said, it only reduces by 40%. But that is that produces considerable savings. When you reduce personnel, you reduce force structure, it impacts on modernization, it impacts on operations and maintenance, it impacts on military construction and family housing. So you get this type of cascaded savings. We also took a look at the challenges that we do face, because military security concerns continue to be substantial. They're not comparable to the Cold War period, and certainly not to the Second World War, but they are significant. And we identified areas that we needed to preserve our strength in. That would be counterterrorism operations. That would also be counterproliferation operations. But there is a reduced requirement for conventional warfare capabilities, and that's the lion's share of our military. There's a reduced requirement for nuclear warfare. And I think coming out of our Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns over these past 8 years, 10 years, I think that the country is not eager to repeat that experience, and I think for good reason. I think we learned, or hopefully we have learned, that there are limitations to what can be accomplished through the application of military power. So we have these various areas that actually speak for a large part of our military, and we can reduce in those areas. What we did, and I'm not going to review all of the elements of the report. I think everyone has an executive summary, and the final version of the report will be available online, now. By looking at those requirements, we came up with the number 1.15 million. And tracing that out throughout the entire system of cost, we discovered that we could save, relative to the president's current plan over the next 10 years, we could achieve more than $550 billion in savings. We could bring the budget down close to the level of sequestration, which is of such great concern to everyone today. But one thing that we don't do is try to implement it all at once because of the disruptive effect it would have on the military and possibly on the economy as well. The plan sees the military going down to that smaller size and that lower budget over a period of 4 or 5 years, and then stabilizing at that level with increases for inflation thereafter. It's one of the distinct ways it differs from sequestration. I'll mention one or two other interesting facets of the model. We did not go in looking to reduce the pay or benefits for military personnel, in part because we need to maintain the morale of the armed forces, and as the military goes down in size, often morale suffers. Also because we think there's something of a moral responsibility, having pushed the military so hard over the past 10 years, And finally, we think that this is where you have an effect on consumption and the economy as well. So we didn't go that route. If we did go that route, as the administration has, we could save another $60 billion over the next 10 years. And finally, one thing we do as we make the military smaller is we move more armed forces personnel into what is called the operating force, the part of the military that actually does the fighting. And we do that by backfilling positions that are currently held by military personnel that are in the infrastructure side of the armed forces. We bring civilians into those positions to free up armed forces personnel to be in the operating force. So while we're reducing the overall size of the personnel on the active component by 19%, we are reducing the operating forces by only 17%. And in most cases, it's less expensive to have civilians do jobs that civilians can do. Our armed forces personnel are very expensive. All of them are trained and equipped to the highest level. And our approach in this report is that if you're going to have that type of asset, that type of personal quality, you want to put it to work in those areas that you have trained people for. And if a civilian can do a job, have a civilian do it. And in that way, we reduce the size of the military by a certain percentage, but the fighting power of the military is not reduced as much. And I'll just conclude there.
Thank you, Carl. Bonnie, our presenters will take questions from participants.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Carl, let me jump in with a question, and also Congressman Frank. Part of the argument here that I briefly covered is that there are broader strategic interests the United States has, and that military is only one part of national strategy. And I wonder if you would like to expand a bit on that in the current situation, especially given the fiscal constraints and pressures that are on the United States and also the economic issues.
Well, I'll begin and say not simply that there are other interests, but that they can be adversely affected. Clearly, it is an interest in ours to have regimes that are friendlier to us, friendlier to some of our allies. What happens is an excessive military response, and at least one that's perceived that way, can do more harm than good. So our ability across to the extent that we're not worried about our physical security, and I think that's pretty well acknowledged, that we're not in the era of the Nazis or the communists so heavily armed to destroy the country. We have the terrorists who are a threat that we have dealt with. By the way, we should note that the military spending we're talking about doesn't count the billions that are spent in homeland security. If people worry about protecting ourselves against terrorism, the great bulk of that is done at home in billions of new spending compared to 10 years ago in the homeland security area. But military activity actually can be giving aid and comfort to some of the political groups we wouldn't want to see doing this. And it also, we have talked about economic assistance, foreign aid of the traditional sort. That's diminished. Our ability to carry on diplomacy, our very ability to protect our diplomats. The military budget being as large as it is, it eats into everything else, and our ability to use resources for other economic and political purposes is substantially diminished, and in some cases, I said, undercut, because the military activity gives rise to a often unfair negative perception of America, but a reality we have to deal with.
As a reminder, to ask a question, press star 1. Our first question comes from Sarah Stockman of Boston Globe.
Hi. Thanks for doing this call. I'm just wondering if you've shared any of these any of this with members of the military. What are your how confident are you that anyone in the military or anyone in the administration would adopt this view?
We've only begun the process of setting up briefings of it. This is literally the first release of the report. We've spent the year conferring with various clusters of people in Congress who were seeking advice on how to approach and think about the sequester and what types of savings might be available there. And in the course of that, we introduced many of these ideas. But we haven't actually begun a process of briefing yet, and you know, and I expect that'll happen soon.
Let me add in here. There are two aspects. There are the works that have been done that talk about reducing weapon systems, being more efficient in deploying for the existing strategic sense. And there, I believe there has been a great deal of interaction with military people, active and retired, and there's a great deal of expertise there. On the broader question about what the political posture in the broader sense of the American military ought to be in the world, that's not a question primarily for the military. We have a superb military. They carry out tasks that we assign them. But whether or not there ought to be, for example, an American capacity, as I just quoted from the Bush administration Assistant Secretary of Defense, to combat or to confront any potential enemy anywhere in the world, whether or not we ought to be providing support in Western Europe to allies that could well do it themselves. These are not questions of military expertise.
Well,
these
so
are,
what about the administration? Do you feel that they might be open to this, or do you think...
Yes, let me put it this way. They are better than they used to be, but not as good as I hope they will be. One of the things we should note is that Mitt Romney did us a service by introducing this into the debate. Remember, Mitt Romney was arguing for the more traditional America must be prepared to go anywhere, everywhere, at any time. And the president quite forthrightly disagreed with him when he kind of ridiculed his argument about we have fewer ships. This was in part debated. And secondly, the administration understands we're in a zero-sum game situation. If you're going to reduce the deficit, which is a national agreement over a longer term, then it's got to come out of somewhere. But I would say, no, the administration isn't yet there where I think they should be. And this is partly an effort on my part and the part of others to lobby them. I tell you, I think you have a little bit of cultural lag here. Democratic presidents have traditionally felt, and Democratic presidential candidates, that they could not be seen to be weak on national security because the public would punish them. And that was true. That's why poor Mike Dukakis wound up in a helmet because he was told by his advisors, you got to look like you're in with the military. I think the public has moved out beyond the politicians here. I note, by the way, that the one line that Clint Eastwood uttered in his rant at the Republican convention that was extremely well received was when he sort of blurted out, let's pull out of Afghanistan, and was applauded in the Republican convention. Mm-hmm. So I think, no, the administration isn't yet where it should be. They did win an election in which Romney was pushing them to do more, and they said, no, we can, as the president said, take the money out of Afghanistan and use it to reduce spending. But I do believe this administration needs to go further, and I think the public is ready to do that, including, and that was the significance of my teaming up with a Tea Party guy. And again, we're not talking here about expertise, which is where the military has to be given a great deal of deference. We're talking about what are the basic purposes of an American military. And one of the things the report makes, you know, very clear, militaries can do some things and not others. They can stop bad things from happening, but they're poor instruments for making good things like democracy and religious tolerance happen in other societies.
A lot of the ideas that we explore in the report have a lively representation inside the military. Advocates for different positions questioning the use of the military in counterinsurgency operations. Of course, there's advocates as well, but there is there a basis for a discussion and a debate. That has not happened so far, I think, mostly because the discussion has been focused on the money question, and it seemed as though that was not an issue that was going to that was going to proceed in a way that, let's say, if there's a consensus opinion inside the armed forces that that they were looking at taking at there being a bloodbath. What has changed since then, I think it was also evident in this election, is that the American public seems more willing than it has in a long time to take a harder look at the defense budget, as well as other parts of the budget, and you can see evidence of that in the way the elections went in Virginia. Big focus for the defense industry, trying to swing contests there in their favor, and it was essentially wasted. The public is raising questions, and inside the military, there's a lot of innovation, a lot of innovative thinking happening in different corners, not principally prompted by the money question, but I think that there can be a convergence there, and that's what we're going to seek. I see change coming. Our report is one of a number that will be coming out from different corners of the think tank world. Over the next 6 months, and we may again have a discussion, a public discussion, about what our military should be doing in the world, what do we really need, and then what is the impact on budgeting and the economy.
Thanks.
Again, to ask a question, press star 1. Our next question comes from Carolyn Lockhead of San Francisco Chronicles.
Thank you. For Congressman Frank, as I recall during the debt ceiling negotiations, Minority Leader Pelosi played a big role in getting this defense sequestration kind of going. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, now, getting it included if there was going to be sequestration. It's
right.
A two-part question. One, should there be sequestration? I and many others said no, but if you're going to have it, then yes, you have to include defense.
Now that she's decided to stay on, how much are Democrats, you and other Democrats, going to push for this in the current fiscal cliff negotiations, and how would you like to see all that?
Oh, a great deal. As you heard earlier, when we had that vote to cut some money out of the military budget recommended by the Appropriations Committee, for the first time in my memory, a majority of the House voted to reduce what the Appropriations Committee recommended, although not by enough, but it was symbolic. I mean, it was very important. 158 out of 190 Democrats voted with us. There will be significant Democratic insistence that, one, we want to replace sequestration with a more intelligent way of reducing expenditures, and two, that has to fall equally on the military as well as non-military. In fact, military is a more than half the discretionary budget, although you have, obviously, it's not more than half the total budget with Social Security and Medicare by any means. But, yeah, many of us on the Democratic side will insist that the kind of military reductions we are talking about here be part of this. And again, note that this isn't reducing pay. It's not in any way reducing the benefits of the individual members. It's essentially saying we no longer need to play as large a self-imposed role militarily in the world as we have over time. And there are savings to be from that. Yeah, you would see there would be zero chance of getting any significant number of Democratic votes for any replacement of sequester that did not include substantial military reductions.
Great, thank you.
At this time, there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you, guys. This has been very good.
Thank you, Congressman Frank.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
All right.
Any final thoughts, Carl, or should we wrap it up?
Well, I think that an interesting question is will the debate in the country take off, and can we begin looking at questions of military strategy without simply the budget issue overhanging us? The country has reason to be concerned about the use of the military or the misuse of the military in various parts of the world. Taking a look at our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, it cost us $1.5 trillion. We fell far short of our goals in both places. It's unclear, and that's a generous assessment. It's unclear that this particular instrument is the way to promote accord, democracy, and development in those countries or anywhere else. This is true regardless of the budgetary situation, that the country is war-weary and within the armed forces and in the national security establishment, people are trying to think through a different way of addressing those security concerns. What we do in the report is say that you can't simply reduce on the military side. You also have to complement by building up the preventative activities of the State Department and other agencies of government. This is not a question of withdrawing from the world. It's not a question of backing out of problems that clearly can find their way to our shores. It's an issue of finding a better balance among the instruments available to us and also trying to build more cooperation, true cooperation, with our strong allies, but also with people who might one day be an adversary, to identify common concerns and to take an approach that actually involves a lot of give and take. So use other instruments of government, which tend to be much less expensive, and pursue the road of greater cooperation as risk management strategies, so that it's not simply a question of drawing down on the military side. It's also a question of building up on other approaches to resolving and addressing security issues.
I think that last point you make about risk strategies is very key here, because once the word risk is brought up, a lot of people default to the idea, well, that just means we need more military instruments and power. The management of risk is actually a lot more complex than that, and there are many opportunities to manage risk in ways that don't involve military power. And I think that's one of the key parts of the argument going forward. And that there's actually a lot of opportunities that have not been pursued to reduce security risks, to develop better relationships internationally, and to diffuse future potential conflicts. So I think that's part of the overall strategic adjustment that we're advocating, looking for, and wanting to explore in a much more serious way than it has been in the past.
Well, along those lines, nothing has been more destabilizing than the recent financial meltdown and its impact on the world. There were some winners and also a lot of losers, but this is a problem that can't be addressed by military means. And I think that what should concern us the most, looking to the future, is that the global constellation of economic power in 2050, that's the world that we're going to bequeath to our children, is going to be as different from today as today is different from 1920. We are moving into an entirely new circumstance. Most of the world seems to understand that the principal strategic challenge today is in the economic realm, and you can see that in how they spend their budgets. We spend 4.7% of our GDP on the military. The world average for countries is 2%, and among the countries that spend less of their wealth on military power is the Chinese. So you know, that's a different reading of what the real challenge is in the world and what is going to determine who are the strong powers, who are the leaders, who are the powers capable of generating large militaries if they need them 20 and 30 years from now.
Well, with that, I'm going to conclude the call. I want to thank everyone for participating say that if you want any additional information or to talk with any of today's participants or copies of the report or how to get copies of the report, please contact our associate Ethan Rosenkrantz at 202-316-7018. Or you can call our office at 617-547-4474. Again, thank you for taking part in our briefing. Goodbye.
Thanks, Carl. Charles. Ethan.
You're welcome.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.